From Milwaukee to Marshfield, where passion meets purpose and policy meets people, this is the Maggie Dawn Show.
It is this moment right now, and we need people that have wealth and access to step the hell up.
Get ready to challenge the status quo with a fresh perspective on the issues that matter to you.
We can't take this as a country to have a leader who is so ill-informed and we look terrible.
Breaking down the complex world of policy and politics with clarity, conviction, and just the right amount of fun.
You got a bad sandwich at your favorite deli. What do you do about it? We can talk about whatever you want to sound off on.
Lawyer, economist, and fearless advocate for the truth. Here is Maggie Dawn.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Well, we have been working furiously to put together for each and every one of you a very special episode today in honor of the July 4th weekend, our celebration of America's independence. It occurred to both me and my senior producer, Jamie, that as we celebrate together with our families, take a few days off of work, and we're celebrating America's independence, that a bit of reflection on America's past and how exactly we got here, and frankly, some of the ongoing threats to our freedoms, to independence, both as a country, as a democratic system, and individual rights seemingly under attack these days. Of course, a country divided cannot stand. And we've got a whole incredible slate of experts lined up to help us understand our present moment in light of our past, to understand our present challenges in light of what we understand about politics, and finally, to make us better consumers of media overall so that we can all be informed citizens to protect our democracy and our individual freedoms. We are thrilled to have with us later on the show, Professor Howard Schwaber, who's been a frequent guest of this program to help us understand the politics of the moment, to dive fairly deeply into that. We're also going to be joined by Kathy Kramer, who's a professor not only of political science, but also of journalism and the media, again, to contextualize how we are ingesting information. Are we good critical consumers of the media ecosphere that's out there, which I sometimes refer to as the information sewer? But to kick us off, to understand our present, we must understand our past. And so I am very thrilled and honored to have with us humanities and history professor David Volker of UWGB. He's an esteemed scholar of early American history, Native nations, as well as environmental humanities. We're going to try to unpack a whole bunch of that. But welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show, David, and happy early 4th of July to you, my friend.
Hi, Maggie. Thank you. Wonderful way to frame this episode. I'm really pleased to be here.
As we are to have you, and to, as I like to say, make us all a little bit smarter, let's jump in, because there is so much from the early American history period, from the Declaration of Independence and the Revolution up through the Civil War, that I think really informs how Americans today view ourselves and view our history. We have lots of narratives, stories that we tell ourselves about what America is, what it stands for. And much of that comes from our shared or not shared understanding of our history. So let's begin the beginning a bit, if you will, with the Revolutionary period and our most important founding document, our Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, we have some common history or commonly known history and myths as well. And some of those myths are some truth to them, but often they profoundly oversimplify the past. And so as a historian, I mean, I'm grateful to be here today because, you know, what I'm trying to do as a historian is to understand the past and its complexity. And we can look to that past sometimes for a warning, like, oh, I think, you know, there's a problem with the trajectory we're on, for inspiration, of course. But first and foremost, I think it's important to try to understand the past on its own terms. So, yeah, I'm happy to talk a little bit about the Declaration of Independence, given where we are in our year. And I think it's important, given our current political debates as well, to look back to the founding principles of the United States. And mythology certainly does come into play here. You know, something I often encounter cynicism among my students about the American Revolution and the Declaration of Independence. And I don't mean that it's widespread and everywhere, but it's a component of the perspective that they bring when they hear those words from the Declaration about all men being created equal. They sometimes say, well, this is just hypocrisy. They didn't mean it. They didn't really mean all men are created equal. But I think that's a misunderstanding. Yes, there was hypocrisy there insofar as, I mean, the man who drafted that language was owned human beings, and owned enslaved people. And so too did many members of the Continental Congress who voted on that, who sent through the Declaration of Independence on July 4th in 1776. But that's not the end of it. I mean, I think on the other hand, we have this mythologizing that, well, the founders were somehow perfect. They created a perfect system and boom, we have our democracy and our like, as if our work here is done. Like we can just look back to that. And I think that's mostly performative, that it's not a serious way to think about our democracy or what self-government looks like. They really see the Declaration of Independence. This isn't my original idea, I have to say, but like this is setting off an experiment in Republican government. And that idea has been very powerful throughout American history. I mean, it's something that Abraham Lincoln spoke about, for example, during the American Civil War. So can I make one point about the Declaration of Independence here that might—
Of course, David.
Yeah, sorry. Well, so that phrase about all men being created equal, I mean, it is easy to dismiss that, to be cynical about it. But I think that the founding generation understood that those were powerful words. And in the state of Massachusetts, and by the 1780s, very similar language actually led to the elimination of slavery. In the original Declaration of Independence, there was a passage that was cut that the delegates from South Carolina and Georgia opposed, in which Thomas Jefferson criticized the institution of slavery. He blamed it on the crown. It was one of the offenses of the crown, but he identified those enslaved people as men. He talked about men being bought and sold, and that referred to not just human males, but men, women, and children, as he well knew. So if you look at that original draft organically, you can see that all men being created equal actually referred to all human beings. Now, the document did, of course, change through the deliberative process there. But I think that the founding generation took that language very seriously, even when they were aware that they were not able to fully realize or implement that vision. Yeah, it seems like you had a question for me. Go ahead.
I did. There's, of course, a million questions that are banging around in my head, David. One of the things that... a way of thinking about it is the Declaration of Independence almost as an accountability document. These ideals that we as American must participate in our government today to ensure that we are, in fact, accountable to those very high ideals that we set forth in 1776. And I wanted to then sort of pivot a little bit. And so first question is that a way of thinking about this? And then secondly, you talked about cynicism, and we face this crisis of cynicism, I think, in this country, especially for cynicism towards those who don't hold our particular political viewpoint, right? How do we break through that cynicism? Is there anything in our history that provides a guidepost for how we can move forward now and break again through some of that cynicism, return to these foundational principles?
Yeah. So I'm going to try to, you have two questions there and I yes. could go in different directions for them, but I want to try to answer them kind of together. I mean, first, I participated in the No Kings Day protests in nearby where I am in Sturgeon Bay and Green Bay. And it was amazing to see the resonance of those principles from the Declaration of Independence. And I think it's really interesting that this is largely coming from Americans who are in the center and left of center, progressive. And I want to be clear, I don't mean radical leftists, because I think such yes. a thing barely exists in the United States. So we're talking about Americans who are quite moderate, who find those principles important, inspiring, and they are using them in terms of accountability to point out the ways in which this Trump administration is running roughshod over those principles and those of the United States Constitution, as you know, as we might interpret it in very plain ways. In other words, without
a room full of lawyers,
and
perhaps,
and so forth. Yes, yeah. So, I think that's it was really wonderful to see that this document, these principles from the founding, do still have resonance. I want to make another reference to the American Civil War here. Abraham Lincoln, as he was campaigning in 1858, he referred to the Declaration of Independence and those principles of all men being created equal as the electric cord that linked the hearts of patriotic and liberty-loving men together. And he was really careful here to say that this applies not only to those people whose ancestors were here at the time of the Revolution, but more recent immigrants. So he was making that claim that these principles can be unifying. And of course, we're going to have different ways of wanting to implement those principles. That's mm-hmm. part of the ongoing experiment, the ongoing debate. Lincoln certainly understood that. And I think people still understand that today.
Yeah, I often think of this and try to engage in discussions, particularly with those who disagree with me, by establishing the what's. We typically agree about the what's. And that allows us to see the debate about how, hopefully in a better light, in a good faith light. Now, certainly our present moments can be quite challenging. Folks, if you're just joining us, we're having a special July 4th preview episode, a getting ready for the holiday weekend here on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Maggie Dawn Show. We're joined by Professor David Volk, a professor of history from the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. We've got just about a minute left. Give me a couple of the mythologies from this early American period that we're going to unpack for our listeners on the other side, David.
Well, I think the idea that North America was just this blank slate where Europeans showed up and, you know, asserted their power, that could be one thing we could talk about. You know, we might want to talk a bit more about this ongoing experiment to establish a democracy here.
An experiment. Work is needed to preserve, protect, and ensure that our democracy flourishes. We're going to pick that up. We're going to debunk some of our American mythologies with our good friend David Volker, professor of history from the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Don't go anywhere. We're going to be right back as we celebrate early 4th of July here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Keep it locked. Welcome back, everybody. Happy early 4th of July from me, your host, Maggie Dawn, and the Civic Media Radio Network. We got a special show for all of you this afternoon. We are looking to our past to understand our present. We're looking into the minutiae of today's political environment to understand how we move forward. And of course, to do all of that, we have to be better consumers of information. And we've got a great slate of guests helping us to do just that. Right now, we're talking with UWGB Professor of History, David Volker. David, we were just about to get in to a couple of the American mythologies or narratives. Mythology kind of connotes falsehoods in many cases. And some of our narratives that we tell about ourselves are more true than others. And we wanted to talk about one in particular, which is this concept of manifest destiny, and link it to something that I think we've been telling ourselves for a long time about this country, which is the idea of American exceptionalism and the idea of a shining city on a hill. Your thoughts first, of course, on manifest destiny and this narrative that we tell ourselves.
Yeah, sure. And I think it's really relevant. President Trump used the phrase manifest destiny in his inaugural address.
Yes, he did.
Earlier this year. And I was really troubled to hear him. And I think it was a deliberate provocation, a provocateur.
Yes.
And I mean, and he was talking about colonizing Mars of all things, which is uninhabited. And you know, that myth of manifest destiny is really this, it goes back to the 1840s, that phrase. I think the idea was older than that, but it was used in explicitly white supremacist ways to talk about the United States conquering North America, not only taking land away from First Nations people or Native Americans, but also within the context of the war with Mexico and taking land from Mexico. I mean, that was a war of empire, which, by the way, Abraham Lincoln opposed, since we've talked a little bit about Lincoln here. That mythology of manifest destiny, it's deeply problematic, deeply troubling because of the ways that it erased Native people from this land, or just suggested that they didn't really count, that they were disposable. And I think that misunderstanding about the history of this continent is fully in play right now in our political discourse. So go ahead.
Just very briefly, I saw, I was visiting with some friends in Arizona who are advocates for the Native American community there. And one of them had a poster up, and it pointed out, I won't use the language because there was a four-letter word in it, but it pointed out the fact that, yo, white people, you weren't here first. Like, so when we talk about immigrants, to really try to come to that discussion with a fulsome understanding of the complexities of our past. And where I wanted to ask you next, and perhaps you were thinking of going there as well, is one of the reasons that we justified or rationalized this at base very racist superiority complex that is manifest destiny was that we are exceptional. We are different. We are ordained by providence to do this. And again, city on a hill, that phrase often attributed to Reagan, but it goes back much further than that, does it not?
Oh, right. Yeah. So that goes back to John Winthrop, one of the leaders of the Puritan migration to create Massachusetts Bay Colony. I think that was from his speech. I hate to throw out dates if I don't know it for sure, but like 1629.
1630.
You know,
I looked it up.
Okay. Yeah.
During the break.
Thank you.
Right on point.
In any case, the way that was used at that time was a little different because those Puritans imagined they were going to be a city on a hill for England and for the larger world of Christianity.
Christendom, yes.
Yes, exactly. One problem here is that North America was not a blank slate. And then in fact, insofar as the United States and American culture is exceptional, the encounter with Native people really contributed to that. I mean, European Americans, even as they were fighting against and taking land from Native people, they were often inspired by their dedication to freedom. They learned from their really incredibly skilled diplomacy. And I think that there's a significant contribution to what we think of as American exceptionalism that's often neglected, and that is the influence of that contact with indigenous cultures here including some influences on the American political system. So as far as American exceptionalism goes, I mean, I see that as a myth. And it's not necessarily a bad myth, because we can try to hold ourselves to some high ideals. And this kind of circles back to where we started our discussion, thinking about the Declaration of Independence. We might also bring the United States Constitution into the discussion, maybe especially as it was amended with the Bill of Rights.
Yes.
And to think about this ongoing American experiment in self-government. And I think, to fit in with some of your main themes here, like, this is really going to require engagement from American citizens. It has to be informed engagement that goes beyond the superficial memes that we might see on social media.
To move forward, we must look back unflinchingly and accurately to see our history and all of its complexity so that we can, in fact, fulfill those highest ideals first articulated in a formal way in the Declaration of Independence, and of course our Constitution, and then the Bill of Rights. My big, big thanks to you, David Volker, Professor of History from the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. Stay tuned. We've got Professor Howard Schwaber joining us next from UW-Madison to understand the politics of the moment and the science of politics to, again, understand how we move forward. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Everybody, welcome. If you're just joining us, my name is Maggie Dawn, host of this, The Maggie Dawn Show, here on the Civic Media Radio Network. And happy 4th of July, early 4th of July, to each and every one of you. We have a special July 4th preview episode today. We began by talking with David Volker of UW-Green Bay. Thanks to David for reminding us of the highest ideals and aspirations of our democracy throughout our founding. I like to call it, you know, our accountability documents, you know, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights. And from time to time, perhaps it's good if we do a little checkup and see how we're doing on those principles and how our democracy has evolved over time. And we've got just the expert to do so with us, frequent guest on The Maggie Dawn Show, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and a really fun guy to talk to about all this. Howard Schwaber, welcome back to the show, Howard. Lovely to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So I've created this conceit, which is a little tortured, but if our democracy was going for its annual checkup, how do you think we're doing?
Well, I think, you know, when you talk about humans, particularly nowadays, those of us who are aging a little around the edges, we think a lot about stages of life. There was when we were young and vigorous. There was healthy adulthood. There was middle age. As a democracy, we're entering, I think, a new phase of life. And it's one not quite as strong or as healthy as the one we just exited. We are having, you know, we used to be, we talked about the United States having growing pains. I think we might be having aging pains. Things are starting to fall apart. Things are just changing, just becoming different than they were before in ways we do not recognize because they're unlike anything we've seen before. And that produces, you know, conflict and concern. And some people are trying to accelerate the process and some people who are trying to slow it down.
When we look at that perhaps aging process or aging pains, as it were, what are the signs that perhaps we have an eroding or weakening democracy, at least as we've historically understood it? And like, what is the thing that some are agitating for us to move towards?
Sure. So a very long time ago, someone described politics as the art of the possible. And it's not a bad way to describe democracy, as, you know, a democracy is stable and healthy when it is working. It also has to guarantee rights and other things. But one question is, you know, how well is it working and how well are settled understandings remaining stable? Since the 1920s, for example, we have had a stable and growing understanding about the basic pattern of separation of powers between the executive branch and Congress. Of course, there have been changes along the way, but it was a stable system. That fundamental basic system is under direct attack to being destabilized and by people who want to see something radically different emerge. This isn't accidental or anything, but that loss of stability to me just feels like an infirmity, you know, like a body that isn't fighting off diseases as well as it used to. So that's certainly one. A second really big thing, I'll stop making the medical analogy. It cuts too close to home. A second example, though, is when things aren't doing what they're supposed to. Organs of government. Oh, I am stuck with this. Organs of government, like organs of the body, just stop doing the basic roles that they're there to do. And both Congress and the courts in recent years can be described as having simply effectively given up on playing their institutional roles at all. That's a strong statement. I'm happy to go into it in detail, but the, you know, it's not so much that the courts and Congress in particular have been captured by people who are energetically and actively using them as part of this process, as they've been captured by people who have worked hard to make them get out of the way. So the idea of checks and balances is simply slipping. And if we're talking about the health of the democracy, that's a very bad sign for itself and very much a sign of a kind of sclerotic freezing up and breaking down of the working of the pieces.
Let me ask you the basic question. To whose benefit? And to whose cost? Sure. To what end? I've often struggled with this. And, as an economist, I think of it, look whose bank accounts are getting fatter. Is it that simple? Who's designed to be the winners and losers if we're losing the separation of powers?
You know, I wouldn't say it's quite that simple, but that's also never absent from any discussion of law and politics. The hard thing, I think, for a lot of people to understand is just how deep a revolution we're talking about. We're talking about people whose goal is to undo the New Deal, and arguably to go further back than that and undo the creation of the administrative state at the beginning of the 20th century. Who benefits from that? Well, anyone who benefits from deregulation, because one of the things that state capacity was developed to pursue was regulation. Anyone who benefits from inequality, because one of the things that entire system broadly conceived was designed to do was to diminish inequality and distribute resources. Anyone who benefits from local authority. So, I mean, this goes back to your historian's discussion, I'm sure. You talked on this, but right, the whole issue of Federalists and Anti-Federalists had to do with the desire of local elites to maintain their states within the states. So, for example, the slaveholders of Eastern Virginia controlled the state against the Western Virginians, ultimately became a different state, who were not slaveholders, were very often anti-slavery. That's just one example, but within states, elites were able to hold control and create, you know, their own systems. When the national government became prominent in the 20th century, local elites lost that ability. I'll stick to the same sort of related analogy. If you ask how did civil rights and desegregation happen, it was a national majority imposed its will over a regional majority. That's one way, an accurate way of describing what happened in the 60s. There are people, so the third category of people who gain from diminishing the capacity of the federal government are people who gain from the restoration of rule by local elites. So there's three examples right there: people who benefit from inequality, people who benefit from deregulation, and people who benefit from local elite domination all have a strong interest in diminishing the role of the federal government. What's missing from all of that, and this is the problem, I think, of, you know, fish not recognizing they swim in water, right? It's so all around us, we don't see it.
Yes.
It's hard to recognize how much over a period of 100 years our national government systems have been built up and become part of all of our lives all the time at making things work, and just how potentially disruptive, to put it mildly, pursuing the kind of dramatic changes that these people, including the members of the Roberts Court, the majority of them, are pursuing, just how disruptive that could be to social lives and institutions across the nation in all sorts of ways.
Yeah, that's, I often think of the invisible hand, and not in the sense of a capitalist economy, but rather in that many to most, to a vast majority, in my opinion, of folks don't understand how much of the quality of their life mm-hmm. is being impacted on a daily basis by the government. And again, access to healthcare. We can even look at just the Supreme Court decision last week, limiting the ability of a patient who is on Medicaid to say, this is my preferred provider. And they basically said, there's no access for you to get any legal redress in the courts, largely giving to states and local elites within states the ability to pick winners and losers amongst healthcare providers that benefit from Medicaid dollars. I mean, truly.
That's a really good example. And everyone remembers, of course, the woman with the sign, keep your government hands off my Medicare. And everyone thought that was amusing, but it reflected the fact that national government systems are part of life. Yes. And dramatically changing them for political purposes is disruptive. So Medicaid is a perfect example. Medicaid was created as a national program to diminish inequality and distribute services, healthcare services, to poor people. It was vigorously opposed by the kind of interests I just described earlier. Of course, Ronald Reagan very famously recorded a radio commercial that says, if Medicare is ever adopted, we will look back and say once there was freedom in this country. In other words, the issues were phrased as very ideologically. The resistance was very strong to Medicaid and to Medicare both, but as a national policy, it was adopted. Fine. That national program is administered at the state level.
Yes.
What we now have is the courts granting or giving to states for the first time the authority to make political calculations of how that redress of inequality will play out. So we went from a situation where poor people simply had no access to healthcare, and on a national level decided that was unacceptable and created this program. Now we're moving to a system of saying, okay, poor people have access to healthcare, but political actors will decide what healthcare they have access to. And yes. You can see how that's just a pulling back from that national commitment and a return of authority and control over who has access to healthcare back to the states, back to the local businesses, and away from the national governmental authority. That's a piece, but an illustration of the retreat from the New Deal model.
Yes.
That resolved the Great Depression, which is that large-scale national economic phenomena require national solutions and national policies, but even further back than that, from the kind of empowered national government model that arose at the beginning of the 20th century, which is the period when we saw things like the Food and Drug Administration,
right,
the Federal Trade Commission, all of those regulatory agencies that are now under attack were created as part of a more than a century-long vision that basically said national problems require national solutions, and local interests can't be permitted to get in the way if we're going to address those problems. That is what is being reversed. And it is fundamentally not only a policy question, but a question of, under our Constitution, what is the scope of the role for the national government? And they're using this constitutional revolutionary argument to push back against a century of policymaking.
So much there, folks. If you're just joining us, that's Howard Schwaber, Professor Emeritus of Political Science from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I often say that regulations are for regular people and small businesses, right, to try to create fairness, ensure that if you are not the person that can afford to buy a complex water filtration system, that you still have clean water, et cetera, et cetera. And I want to return when we come back, Howard, because we're going to have to take care of a little bit of business here. The idea of freedom and the government as inhibiting freedom versus the government under this century of New Deal, the growth of the administrative state, actually being designed to increase choice and increase freedom by increasing overarching economic fairness, access to healthcare, all these things. Which one? There are these sort of two competing visions of the world and how government is functioning. One is government as oppressor, at least the national government as oppressor, and must be opposed and dismantled in almost every conceivable way. And the other that envisions, again, not only the national government to address national problems to avoid race to the bottom or race to the top, depending on which issue you're talking about. But by doing so, increasing choice for people that didn't have much choice before, and thereby increasing our freedoms. Are those freedoms actually under attack? Are we worried about the wrong boogeyman? We continue this discussion with Professor Howard Schwaber on the other side. I'm Maggie Dawn, and this is the Civic Media Radio Network. Back and happy early 4th of July. My name is Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Well, we are putting together for you today a very special episode. We started with an historian from the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, to help us understand our present. We must accurately grapple with our complex past. And right now we're speaking with political scientist, Professor Emeritus from the University of Wisconsin, Madison, Howard Schwaber. Right before the break, Howard, you were describing how what we have seen since effectively the 80s is a concerted attempt by elites, in large part, to remake our constitutional democracy and to undo many of the systems and processes and regulations that came about after the Great Depression and the New Deal. And it's interesting to me because I think a lot of the frame that is employed and deployed to great effect by conservatives is that the government is the source of your economic and other existential angst, that it is the government that is the problem, that it is the government that is the oppressor. But that is not the entire picture. At least it may be argued to be an incredible distortion that the programs from the New Deal, the regulatory systems, were, as I like to say, designed to help regular people, those that don't already have cachet and cash, to bend systems and processes and businesses to their will and to their benefit, that it was designed to actually create more choice for regular people. And freedom's only freedom if you actually have choices to make. And I just wondered your reaction to my sort of meta take on what we're talking about here.
Well, it's a very deep point, and it's fundamental to discussions of liberty and democracy. You know, we could go all the way back to John Locke, but we don't have to. In 1787, and not to tread on the toes of your historian, but a little history. In 1787, James Madison wrote an essay called Considerations on the Government of the United States. It was his argument for what was wrong with a system in place and why we needed a constitution and a strong national government. And the thing that he emphasized over and over is that states are denying people their freedoms and their rights. You know, a strong government at one level can prevent government at another level from being oppressive, even if the threat to rights is the government. But there's a whole other dimension that you're referring to, I think, about ordinary people's choices. We take for granted that our drinking water will not kill us, that our sewage systems work well enough, they will not have yellow fever epidemics, as we did in places like Philadelphia and New York and Baltimore in the early part of the 20th century when we didn't have these systems in place. As I mentioned before, it's not just the New Deal. This is a set of approaches and systems that goes back to the Progressive Era. It's in pieces. There's the regulatory pieces, there's the social support pieces, but the regulatory state was always understood as something to enhance personal freedom. You know, Henry Ford once said, "They can have my car in any color they want as long as it's black." That's a version of freedom that doesn't include choice. And unquestionably, there are excessive regulations. Unquestionably, government right. at all levels, federal, state, and local, become burdensome and oppressive. And unquestionably, governments can be dangerous instruments to intrude on people's freedoms, but they are also the instruments that protect people's freedoms and protect real choices. That's the balancing challenge. And to go either too far in either direction is to lose that balance in one way or another. There are very good reasons to complain that the current national government is too big, it's too bureaucratic, it has too many regulations. There are really legitimate complaints on that score. But to undermine the institutional framework is to drastically reopen you know, all those doors we worked so hard to close that kept out dangers to public health and kept out the ability of private actors to treat people, their workers, as property, and preserved spaces for choices and action. So, you know, you can think of this as just a matter of too extreme, like a baby with the bathwater problem. Mm-hmm. But I think it's more than that. I think this is a genuine attempt to make revolutionary change. And I think the reason among popular observers this is not as alarming as people like me think it should be is because perhaps, you know, we don't draw the connections to all the things that we take for granted that would in fact be imperiled. And all the dangers that we were responding to when we created these things that would be revived if this change really were to go forward in the kind of sweeping way that many of its proponents wanted to.
Let's talk a bit about the abrogation of their responsibility to ensure balance within the federal government, that abrogation of the responsibility by Congress and by the Supreme Court, both as it relates to decisions from the Supreme Court, specifically about our democratic system, as well as decisions by the Supreme Court that limit access to our system.
Okay. So really, there's really two sides to this. One, I mean, presently Congress is dominated by a particular party. Congress, when we're talking about Donald Trump, obviously, Congress could rein in Donald Trump's action tomorrow. They choose not to. So, you know, that's not a systemic failure. That's the actors in place not doing their job in the way that, again, Madison assumed that they would. Madison assumed that checks and balances would work because Congress would not allow its power to be taken away by an ambitious president. This is a Congress that seems eager to see its
judicial prerogatives
taken over by a president. And Madison just didn't see that coming. The second thing is, let me draw a line here, if I may. Take any policy that you think is awful, and it doesn't really matter what party it came from, but this year we would be talking about something from Trump, right? Ask how it got that way. So you have a process within the administration. Go back a step. Why isn't Congress doing anything to stop it? Because Congress is dominated by a party. Why is that party not doing anything to stop it? Because gerrymandered districts mean that getting reelected means winning the primary, which pushes the party to be more polarized to extremes. Why is that true? Well, because among other things, the Supreme Court has said that political gerrymandering is perfectly constitutionally acceptable. Why is that true? Well, because if you go back to the framing of the Constitution, it does not contain. It's the only modern constitution that does not contain guarantees of free and fair elections. It's this long line going from constitutional design right down to specific policy decision, and they all connect. And if you are upset by what the government is doing or not doing, to be effective about that, you have to follow that all the way back to you and ask what's wrong with our parties, what's wrong with our elections, and why aren't our institutions, starting with the courts, stepping in to prevent this kind of breakthrough?
Thank you, Professor Howard Schwaber. Next up, we've got media expert Professor Kathy Kramer as we discuss our democracy here on the Civic Media Radio Network.